Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Paul Lawrence, a partner in PricewaterhouseCoopers, and our conversation today is with Dr. John Barkowski, professor of sociology at Mississippi State University, and we're talking about faith-based initiatives. Well, one of the things people get very uncomfortable with, John, is the notion of religion and also the delivery of government services. How should we think about that?
Well, actually, charitable choice helps us to think about that in some ways, though there are some concerns that people have, you know, despite the change in the law. As I had mentioned previously, charitable choice is supposed to protect the TANF clients or, you know, for instance, a poor family's religious liberty. They cannot be forced to accept services from a faith-based provider. There has to be a secular alternative there. But there are some concerns that people have concerning or regarding charitable choice implementation. The ideal of the law is to protect religious liberty. But one of the concerns people have is, for instance, in, I guess, rural areas where it might be hard to provide a secular and a faith-based option right in the same locale if you've got a highly dispersed population. There are some people who might feel like if the faith-based option is much closer to home, maybe that's the one to go with, despite any misgivings they may have about a particular congregation who's supporting them. I will say that faith-based providers are forbidden from requiring the recipients or clients that they serve from attending worship services. So, for instance, if I'm a Catholic congregation and I've petitioned for and received monies from the state government, for example, I cannot require that a client in my services program comes to Mass every Sunday or comes to some type of, you know, Bible study or something else on a Wednesday evening, for example. Still, there are a lot of folks who have concerns about the ideal law. I mean, the ideal principle, I guess, in the law is one of protecting religious liberty and religious freedom. But the concern is, on an everyday basis, will that ideal stand up? In other words, will congregations try to skirt around these types of principles to say, well, you know, so-and-so really isn't interested in receiving our the full gamut of our services because this person isn't, say, coming to church on Sundays. So there are concerns of, like, how are you going to actually monitor and manage charitable choice implementation? There's a lot of talk from the Bush administration right now about how to evaluate programs. And, I mean, their answer is very simple, performance. If you can teach illiterate children how to read, you will be able to get the money and, you know, basically maintain the relationship if you can stay competitive. But there are other issues beyond performance in terms of evaluating programs, and that's monitoring and making sure that the programs are in keeping with the law. Now, I'm not saying that congregations will try to skirt around the principle of the law, but I do think the ideal of the law lends itself to many different interpretations about what exactly does religious liberty mean, how committed is this client to our congregation if he or she is not shining around other than to receive the services. So there are kind of practical considerations that some folks raise that really give them some concern about charitable choice.
Well, we've talked about some of the potential issues, especially in terms of the context of requiring people to attend services or however the religion is practiced. But what are some of the strengths of using religious organizations to provide these services?
One of the strengths is the social networks in religious organizations. Social networks are, in religious communities especially, are very, very powerful mechanisms for promoting social change. So, you know, here I am in the rural South thinking that, you know, if it weren't for a lot of the African-American congregations here, we probably wouldn't have seen the same civil rights movement that we saw in the 1950s and 60s. Social networks in congregations can be very powerful engines for social change and transformation. And in the case of poverty relief, Mississippi congregations do a whole lot in that regard. Mississippi is actually the most giving state in the nation, despite the fact that it's the poorest state in the United States. It also marks the most monies spent in charitable contributions. So essentially, Mississippi, I mean, because it's a highly churched population, a lot of the culture in Mississippi and, frankly, throughout the United States is formed along the lines of church and faith community fellowships. So there's lots of talk right now about, you know, civil society and moving away from a government-centered model of social services, moving towards a voluntary sector. And what I would argue is that religious congregations have long been a staple in the voluntary sector in terms of providing relief to people in need and providing for social support when people need it. So that's probably the strongest element of change that can come about. Why wouldn't you just go with a kind of secular model? A lot of religious folks would say that, you know, what they're doing is distinctive and different than a secular model. They're appealing to, I guess, to use the term that some folks in Alcoholics Anonymous use, this kind of idea of a higher power. So that particular concerns and theological considerations that motivate human action in religious organizations in a way that they don't in other organizations, say secular providers of social services.
What kind of management challenges do you think the Office of Faith-Based Initiatives will face as they try to implement this?
That's a great question. One of the challenges I think they're already facing is that certain religious communities are going to be jockeying for position and for kind of collaborative clout with the Office of Faith-Based Initiatives. One of the things we saw actually not too long ago was that some Jewish leaders from the Anti-Defamation League approached John DiIulio at the Office of Faith-Based and Community Initiatives and basically raised concerns. You know, is the office going to support the Nation of Islam or programs through the Nation of Islam? Now, I don't wish to point out, you know, these two religious groups. There are a lot of religious groups that have some degree of historical antagonism between them or are at odds on certain theological, practical, social issues. And I think that this is one of the big challenges they're going to face. Other sociologists have echoed this claim. How is one going to determine which religions are legitimate and which ones are not? As a sociologist, I'm very uncomfortable with any one person or a board of directors or a particular office making choices about what religions are legitimate and what are not. I would recommend and support the Office of Faith-Based Initiatives in the sense that they're really trying to promote a message of religious diversity. So they're saying that, you know, hey, you know, Muslims, Christians, Jewish leaders and community and congregations, other faith communities are all welcome to the table here. And I agree that that's a very, very important move. But I would say once you get all those people to the table, you're going to be probably facing some antagonism and some power dynamics that play out there that are going to really require some careful adjudication.
Based on your research, what lessons could you pass along to other religious organizations that are planning to become involved in service delivery?
The first message I would pass along is one of education. And I would say in this way, again, I think the Office of Faith-Based and Community Initiatives is an important development because religious congregations have felt kind of out of the loop, a number of them anyways, that we've spoken to and just even basically kind of reading work of other people. Some of them are really hooked into their local communities quite well, so it's very common for religious congregations to collaborate with, you know, social workers and other people in the Department of Human Services on a local level. But one of the things they need to know is that charitable choice happens largely at a state level. And so one of the things that religious congregations need to do is to educate themselves about what charitable choice entails. For example, that if I participate in this program and provide relief to a client or some type of money to a client or social services in some fashion, I cannot require that client attend my worship services, and that client cannot be penalized for failing to do so. In another way, religious congregations can educate themselves about financial management issues, what it takes to become an incorporated organization, to compete for contracts with the government, and how to set up an account if they receive those monies. So there are these types of issues that I think congregations need to be educated about. And it's not just placing the responsibility at the congregational level, but I think the Office of Faith-Based and Community Initiatives, as well as state government, movements have the responsibility to help build bridges to congregations so that the only hand extended isn't coming from the religious community, but is also coming from, you know, the state and federal government.
Well, John, that's great. I want to thank you for taking some time to join us today.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks very much, Paul.
This is the Business of Government Hour. We'll rejoin our conversation on faith-based initiatives in just a minute.